What would you do if you were told you had a terminal disease and a short time to live? Well, after being diagnosed with a fatal brain cancer, my guest this morning decided to set forth on a personal priority list and help others discover their own as well. And he's going to share what he's learned with us, as he does in his book, The Priority List. Joining me this morning is David Menashe, former teacher and author of The Priority List, A Teacher's Quest to Discover Life's Greatest Lessons. David Menashe, welcome to the Joy Cardine program. First, I guess I'd have to say, there are no former Marines. There probably aren't any former teachers.
I'd have to agree with you on that.
So tell us about your life before your diagnosis. You were a full-time teacher. What did you teach, and what was your relationship like with your students?
I taught English at Coral Reef Senior High School in Miami, Florida. It's one of the best public high schools in the country. It's currently rated 46th out of over 2,000. And I spent my entire teaching career there, teaching high school English to mostly 11th graders. And I did this as a rookie teacher at the school on the first day the school was opened. I'm part of the opening staff. And as I said, I spent my entire career there and only left because I suffered a stroke as a result of my brain tumor that left me mostly blind and crippled. At that point, I could no longer drive to school, much less be effective in front of a room of 35 or 40 teenagers. So I had to step aside.
Mm-hmm. How long were you able to stay in the classroom after you got your diagnosis?
6 years. I was undergoing daily radiation, chemotherapy, and a number of brain surgeries, and I almost never missed a day. It really was the reason I got up in the morning and the reason I put up with all the treatment was to see my kids, to be in front of my class, and to have some kind of a purpose.
And when you first got the diagnosis, your doctor wasn't very hopeful about your outcome. I mean, you basically got told, what, you had a couple of months?
Exactly.
The fact that, and that was how long ago?
That was the day before Thanksgiving in 2006. I was diagnosed with glioblastoma multiforme, which is the most aggressive form of cancer. And I had a tumor inside my head roughly the size of a golf ball, which is very large considering the size of my brain or anybody else's.
So how did you start to notice that something was amiss?
Initially, I was hearing a ringing sound in my ear, in my left ear. So I went to see my general practitioner about it, and he sent me to a series of specialists, ear, nose, and throat guys, none of which could find anything wrong. But then that same ringing sound turned into a tingling sensation that I was feeling throughout the left side of my face and then later down my body. At this point, I went to see a neurologist who gave me a series of tests, all with acronyms for names, EEG, EKG, CAT, MRI. And finally, it was the MRI that revealed I had a brain tumor and that if I didn't have emergency surgery, I wouldn't make it 2 months.
So there you are in 2006, just before Thanksgiving. You've got some kind of health issue, but you don't know what it is. Your doctor calls, your doctor's office calls you and says you need to come in and bring somebody. That must have been a pretty awful day for you.
Yes, I was waiting for the MRI results, and I was being very optimistic about it. Nothing was wrong with me according to the other ones, so I thought I would get away with this one as well. And I'm waiting at school for the phone call, and I get the call from my doctor's assistant telling me that I need to come into the office, that my results are ready. And I know the assistant. She's a nice girl, so I just asked her if she could just tell me what they are. And her voice went very grim. She said, oh, no, I can't. You're going to have to talk to the doctor. And I told her, but I'm at school. I can't. The soonest I'm going to be able to get out of here is 5 o'clock. And then she tells me the doctor will wait for you. And that just sent a chill down my spine. It was hard enough making appointments with him weeks in advance. And the idea that he was going to stay in his office and wait for me, I knew right away this was bad news. I didn't know how bad, but I knew that there was definitely something wrong, that the MRI had found something. And it occurred to me at that point, right when I hung up the phone, that is the last moment that my life was going to be normal, that no matter what the doctor had to tell me, everything was about to change. And that was about the only thing I was right about. It turns out that tingling sensation I was feeling was a seizure. And I was having about 5 seizures a day, often right in front of my class. But I had good discipline about it. I would step into the hall or face my computer so they couldn't really see me. And I eventually learned discipline to control it so my body wouldn't move and nobody could notice it. And then later, when I was on chemotherapy, I started getting nausea and throwing up. And that, too, was something that I made into basically an art form. Next door to my classroom was the bathroom. And I learned to slip out of my class, go into the bathroom, heave, throw up, and then brush my teeth and be back inside my room in under 3 minutes without my kids being none the wiser.
Well, how did your student...
It really wasn't until the stroke when I became seriously disabled that I stopped teaching.
Okay. So how did your students react when you told them the news?
Well, it wasn't so much that I told them the news. On the first day of school, all the kids noticed that I had a massive scar on the side of my head from one of my surgeries. It was the elephant in the room. And on the first day of school, traditionally, you open up the floor to questions. And with high school kids, that question always came up. How'd you get that scar? You know. And I always treated my students as adults, so I explained to them that I have brain cancer and I had surgery to reduce the size of the tumor, and this is the resulting scar. I didn't shield them from it or hide them from the actual truth of the situation. I was just trying to save them from having to have cancer with me, because then the class would entirely be focused on me and my disease rather than the subject matter. So when I was feeling ill, I kept that part away from them, but they knew what was going on in the larger sense of things.
Mm-hmm. So how did you make the transition from the state of shock, which anyone would be in, and let's face it, sadness about your diagnosis, to a determination to turn this into an opportunity to share life lessons with others?
Well, when I did become disabled and lost the ability to have my classroom, I was looking for a new job. I didn't want to just sit around the house like a dog waiting to be walked. And I really did try to find a job, but it is a difficult job market, and I couldn't find anybody that wanted to hire a one-armed blind guy with a terminal disease. So that really put me into a funk, where I was just sitting at home, glowering at a television I couldn't see, staring at the spines of books I could no longer read, and just with nothing to do. So I decided I'd like to write, and then quickly realized that all of my best stories were from my classroom over the last 15 years, and that if I wanted the rest of that story, I was going to have to go out and get it. So I put a post on Facebook saying I would like to do some traveling and asked if any of my former students had a couch for me. Within 48 hours, I had offers in 50 cities. And that was the first time I shed a tear since the night I got my diagnosis. But this wasn't a pure sadness. It was just overwhelming how these kids, who I had done my best to help over the last 15 years, were now opening up their doors, their homes, and their hearts to me. And that just melted me. It really was something incredible.
Well, I want to hear more about that journey, and because that's, you know, that's the crux of what we're talking about here today. But I want to find out before that how your health challenges changed your approach, if at all, to your teaching. You talked about some of the physical things that you did to attenuate the effect of your illness on your students. But did it change your approach to teaching at all when you... In what way?
Yes. Well, in my entire life, I developed a certain sense of urgency that my time was short and thus valuable. And my classroom time was no different. Whereas a lot of my colleagues, if they didn't feel like teaching on a given day, they would show a movie or just make their kids write all day and sit at their desk. I couldn't do those kinds of things. I needed to make sure that every minute inside of my class was valuable, both to my students and to me. My kids would ask me, well, you know, if you have cancer, why aren't you out doing something you love, doing that bucket list kind of stuff? Which I can only answer, I am doing what I love. But I wouldn't have loved it if I was just sitting at a desk waiting for my students to finish watching a movie. I needed to be active and involved and to feel like this was valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Friedrich Nietzsche once said, I'm paraphrasing him now, that a person who has a why to live can always find a how. And for me, my class, my kids, I don't have children of my own, so those were my kids, were my why. And the how was by making sure my class was interesting, exciting, and fun. I taught my students on a one-on-one basis. I didn't lecture to a group of 40. I had individualized education, and it served to distract me from the other role I was playing in my life as cancer patient, and it gave me a reason to suffer through all the chemo treatments and surgeries.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the book, The Priority List, A Teacher's Final Quest to Discover Life's Greatest Lessons, with its author, David Menashe. And with you, if you'd care to join us and ask your questions of our guest, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. And listeners, think about this. What would be on your priority list? What if you had gotten the news that David Menashe got in 2006? What would be on your personal priority list? How would you manage that? 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org is the email address, and you can join us on Facebook. Look for the Joy Cardine program and put your comment or question there. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The title of the book is The Priority List, A Teacher's Final Quest to Discover Life's Greatest Lessons. The author, David Menashe, is with me this morning and with you at 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine today. So, David, you came up with a priority list. Tell us about what that is, and how did you come up with it initially?
I had an assignment that I used to give my students. My students being 16 years old, which, if you remember, is likely the time in your life where you were going through the most change. Learning to drive, falling in love for the first time, experimenting with drugs, alcohol, identity, all while you're trying to figure out what kind of a career you want to have, where you want to live. It is just a time of massive, massive change. And I wanted my students to stop and take a moment and reflect on who they were. So I came up with an assignment that I called the priority list. And this is a list of 26 abstract words. Words such as respect, love, wealth, honor, fun, family, friendship, spirituality, possessions, career, education. And I gave my kids a list, and first I asked them to come to a personal definition of the word. A lot of these words are very difficult to define, even for an adult, much less a 16-year-old. What is wealth or love or honor? So once they came to those personal definitions, I asked them to number the words in order of importance, personal importance. They would put a number one next to whatever it is that they thought was most important to them, and a number 26 next to the ones, next to the ones that were least important. And after they would do this, I would look at how they ordered their words, and it was incredibly revealing. When I saw a student put victory next to career, it meant a very different thing than a person who put victory next to sex. And it helped my students in touch with who they were, or at the very least, who they were at that moment. And it helped me to understand who my students were as individuals. We would do this assignment twice in the year, once at the beginning and then again at the end. And I would have my kids compare the list and look at the changes and try to figure out why there was such change. For instance, if the word love appeared at number 3 at the beginning of the year, but was at number 24 at the end of the year, there was clearly a good story there and writing assignment. And I would hear the story of heartache and heartbreak and getting cheated on and all of these kinds of things. And I would encourage my students to continue doing this throughout their lives, to reevaluate what is important to them and to make sure that they're spending their time on the things that were important to them.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you did, looking for a way to start meaningful discussion, you came up with a system you named the spiral. Tell us about that a little bit. What is the spiral and how does that work?
Well, I'll try to explain it to you in the same way I explained it to my students. I would go to the board and the whiteboard and take my marker and just stick it on the board and say, okay, when we are born, we are all here. We are all this. And I would start to draw a spiral. and say, we are incredibly self-centered. As a toddler, if you're holding a lollipop, that lollipop is the only thing that matters to you. You're not paying attention to what your family or friends are doing. You want that lollipop. And if you drop it, if it gets dirty, if you lose it, you will cry and cry and cry. Not because you've just lost a lollipop, but because you've lost everything that has ever mattered to you. And at this point, we're maybe one ring away from that center. And I'm saying, as toddlers, you're incredibly self-centered. And I would continue to draw the spiral larger and then say, but as we turn old, as we get older and more mature, when you're 8, 9 years old, now you do care about your neighbors and your parents and your future, what you're going to get on your birthday. And then I would continue going outward and outward and saying, but as we get more and more mature, we start to consider other things that are further from our personal lives equally as important as the stuff that's happening on our block, in our neighborhood, in our bedrooms. You might start caring about starving people in Africa, war in the Middle East. And I would continue this spiral until I finally got to about as large as the board could handle. And I'll say, a lot of you are going to reach this point when you become parents, because at this point, you're going to care about somebody else more than you care about yourself. And this is where you want to be, whether it's for your own children or whether it's for a cause. This is where you want to be, at the outside of this spiral. And with every lesson I taught, I would remind myself that they're teenagers and that they are self-centered. So, for instance, if we were going to look at the essay, The Ways We Lie by Stephanie Erickson, I would start by having my kids spend 10 minutes or so writing about a time when they were lied to or a time when they told a lie. So they're talking about themselves, which they're inherently interested in. And then from there, from that center of the spiral, I would introduce them to the author's opinion on it. And then the other students in the class would start to comment and they would have this discussion until finally we got away from their own initial opinion and had this new one, which has evolved with the opinions of others, including myself. So all of my lessons started with them, but took them away from that spot to a larger perspective on whatever the topic may be.
And how did your students react to the spiral assignment?
They loved it. And as I was traveling the country, one of my initial questions I would ask is, what do you remember most from my class? And time again, it was the priority list. The kids loved spending time thinking about themselves, but also thinking and really trying to decide who is more important to them. Is it their family or is it their friends? And I would challenge them not to just answer the way they thought they were supposed to answer, but to really look at how they spend their time, who's giving them happiness, who do they go to when they need a shoulder to cry on or to lean on, and really make them think about these things in their life and how much attention and care they're giving to them.
We're talking about the book, The Priority List, A Teacher's Final Quest to Discover Life's Greatest Lessons. David Menashe is the author. He's with me this morning. And with you as well at 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org or on Facebook. We have some callers who want to join the discussion this morning. Let's go to northeastern Wisconsin first and hear from Gretchen. Gretchen, thanks for joining us today.
Hi. Hi, David. I just wanted to say it was really refreshing to hear you say that when you got that call, that you knew that things were going to change. And something that you wouldn't feel, things would not be the same from this point on. And 2 years ago, my 5-year-old was diagnosed with cancer. And
I'm so sorry,
when I got
Gretchen.
when I got that call, it's like time stood still. And I remember the road I pulled off on to talk to him and that type of thing. And I have 2 older children as well. And there seemed to be a theme that went along with hearing that. And there's a couple of them, one such as gratitude, because there was so many people in the community and our family that reached out to us. And also just learning the priority of, I need to live today purposefully. And I need to live today intentionally, and I need to live today one knowing that it's one day at a time, and that's all we can do. and things can change in a day, and they did change in a day. And while my priorities, you know, don't quite relate exactly to yours, I think that it is, you know, I feel blessed that God let me be her mother, and just to be able to be the one to nurture and learn that what is really valuable. And I just had this urgency to, you know, get rid of everything I had. Like, whoever needed it, just take it. You need clothes, you need shoes, you need a coat, you need a couch. I don't care about any of those things. Just take it, you know. And I think that there was just a lot of things put back into perspective in our lives. And I hope for other people that it wouldn't take a cancer diagnosis to let them see the joy in every day that is possible.
Gretchen, thanks so much for sharing that with us. David Benashi?
Yes, Gretchen, you're absolutely right. The only moment any of us is truly guaranteed is this one. And tonight, any one of us could receive a phone call that a loved one of ours has been hurt or worse, and everything changes. So if there is something that you want to say to your loved ones, if there's something you want to do, do it now. Because if you put it off, you may not have another chance at it. We all, I mean, I hate to be the person who breaks this news to your listeners, but we are all going to die, every one of us. And it's true that I may have less time than most of you, but that doesn't mean that today is any more or less valuable to you than it is to me. Take advantage of the fact that you are healthy, that you are happy, that you have loved ones, and enjoy that, because all things must pass. Nothing lasts forever.
What about your family? How did they react to your diagnosis? And what kind of support have you had in your community?
It's a very good question. Thank you for asking. Different members of my family reacted differently, and my mother initially, it just crushed her. So I quickly told her, "Don't worry, Mom, I've got this." And I took on this persona, and eventually grew to live up to it, that there is no reason for people to worry about me. This is a natural process. As I said earlier, what's going to happen to me is going to happen to everybody, and I can handle this. This is just my new normal, my new reality. It doesn't make you love me any less or me love you any less. We're going to get through this. And that became my mantra. I got this. And it is also the behavior that I displayed in front of my kids, because I learned quickly that when people asked me how I was feeling, if I was honest, I would only make them feel miserable and pity me, and then helpless and awkward to the point where they wouldn't want to tell me about their lives or their problems. So in a large sense, in an effort to protect the people around me that I cared about, I shielded them from the truth, and I just shouldered it myself. I got this.
You talked about how your mother reacted. How did the rest of your family respond?
Well, my father is a very stoic man, and he didn't see this as anything that could stop me. And he was very encouraging, saying, "Come on, you've been through worse than this. Do you remember the time you were in the car accident or the time you got into a fight?" And I appreciated that, because he did remind me that, you know, there were other incidents in my life, and I did get through those. And really, through him, I learned that you don't know how tough you are until you have to be.
Mm-hmm. You have an older brother as well, and he had some early advice for you.
Well, Jacques, who is my older brother, but more importantly, best friend, mentor, and teacher, he was the very first person that I called when I got my diagnosis. And at this point, I was out of control. I was not just crying, I was sobbing. This is wailing and gnashing of teeth. And at this point, my doctor had just told me they wanted to do a biopsy on the tumor to see how bad it really was. And I'm calling my brother Jacques to tell him that, you know, I have this tumor and they want to do a biopsy, and I'm sobbing so hard I can barely get the words out. I'm crying in that way that four-year-olds cry, where you're sucking in air after every third word. And he's telling me, "You know, you've got to calm down. They don't know anything yet. You've got to be tougher than this." And when he told me, "I've got to be tougher than this," That's when I snapped into that role where I said, you're right. Don't worry about me. I've got this.
Hmm.
And that's where it was born from. And I've been living that way ever since. Not bemoaning what my current lot is and wishing that I had my both of my hands and that I was fully sighted, but appreciating what I still have. Because the unfortunate reality of my existence is, no matter how awful I feel on any given day, no matter how little I can move my fingers or foot, it's better than I'm going to be able to do it tomorrow. This thing is going to progress. So when I look up at the sky, I take a little mental snapshot and try to store it away, because I honestly don't know if I'm going to be able to look at it again tomorrow.
Mm. Let's take another call here. Sheila is in Milwaukee.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Are there some lessons here for healthcare professionals? Does your speaker, how could have healthcare professionals assisted you better at the point of diagnosis in changing attitudes towards purpose and how in your life?
Certainly. Well, I'll say this. I hope all healthcare professionals understand that their patients are laymen. And when you start speaking in medical jargon, it makes us feel even sicker, even more lost. When I was first given my diagnosis, my doctor explained the size of the tumor to me in millimeters and in a language I just didn't understand. Glioblastoma multiforme was not something I could even say in one breath. You know, say it like it is. Say it plainly. Tumor. Cancer. I had to fish around with these questions until I finally got those words. In fact, I didn't understand the size of my tumor until my doctor explained it to me in fruit. He put his two fists together and said, this is the size of your brain. Now, you have a brain tumor that's about the size of a small lime. So imagine in your right hand, you're holding a lime, and he opens his hand a little larger and says, your hand representing your healthy brain, which is now being crushed up against your skull by this tumor. And the more it crushes your brain, the more it is going to harm you until it eventually kills you. I would have preferred to have heard that right away than to have to wade through endless Wikipedia articles and definitions to figure it out for myself. Treat your patients as adults, as peers, and as humans, and speak to them as you would a friend, not a colleague. One of the things I really hated about the way my medical professionals were treating me is that in their eyes, I didn't feel like I was anything but a patient. And their only concern for me was what the numbers were showing, what the test results were showing, without really much care for my spirit, for my emotional state. And those really are the things that ended up keeping me alive. And it would be nice if doctors focused on keeping spirits up as much as they did blood cells and tumors, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sheila, thanks for the call and the question. Let's take a call from Cliff in Appleton next. Cliff, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. One comment good morning, that you Cliff. Made, the person, good morning. The person who has a cry for living will surmount almost any how, reminded me of something possibly by Viktor Frankl, a German psychiatrist who wrote Man's Search for Meaning, or possibly Helmut of Kaiser. Another German psychiatrist, and I'm wondering if you read any of those authors as you...
Well, I got it from Friedrich Nietzsche, who's also German. So. I mean, it's a school of thought at the time that I had subscribed to, yes. But no, I haven't read those authors.
Cliff, thanks for the call. So you decided to hit the road and go on a vision quest. You also decided not to continue your medical treatments. Could you explain what was going on with you at that point?
I couldn't do both at the same time.
Okay.
I had to come off treatments. I was getting chemotherapy every other week, and there was no way I could fly back from California to Miami, from Maine to Miami every other week to receive treatment. Besides, if I was on chemotherapy, I would not have been able to endure the trip. I mean, truth is, John, that I had spent 6 years on chemotherapy. I underwent 6 weeks of radiation every single day after school. I've had 3 brain surgeries. And after all of that, I still went blind and crippled. So I decided, look, you know, Dying from cancer is one thing, but this vomiting and the nausea and all of the stuff that was resulting from the treatment was my choice. I chose to do those things. I chose to make myself that sick. So I chose to stop making myself feel ill, and I quit all treatment, and I set out on the road by myself, blind and crippled, in the winter, to the coldest places in the country. When I was in Minneapolis, it was 20 degrees below zero, which for me, as a Miami kid, isn't just cold. It's the temperature of the apocalypse. I know out in Wisconsin, you guys get used to that kind of stuff, but...
You never get used to it. Take my word for it.
For me.
Yeah.
Breathing was painful. I had what I didn't even know existed. I had snotsicles. Luckily, the former student I was visiting was kind enough to just flick them off my nose periodically. But doing that, being that cold, and being with Emily, my former student, was still better than being in a hospital, tethered to a bed by IV tubes, and having as many needles in me as an average pincushion would.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was going to be a win-win situation. Either I was going to die on the road, which would be preferable to just withering away in that bed, or I would pull this trip off and be able to regain my confidence and sense of purpose.
So how did you decide your itinerary?
Well, initially, very stupidly, I just asked my students when it was going to be good for them that I come and let them give me the dates. And I set out with the intention of, you know, doing it when it was convenient for them. But that had me zigzagging all over the country. If you look at my trajectory on the map, it looks like a star in the first month and a half, where I'm backtracking back to the same cities because the next person simply wasn't ready for me. But by the time I got to the New England area, when I was in New York, I was so fed up of having to spend every night calling the person in the next city to make sure someone would pick me up at the train station that I finally just made a decision. It's going to be 2 nights and 3 days in every town. And I just laid it out and finally just told the people in, for instance, Portland, I'm going to be there from January whatever to January whatever. Can I stay with you? And if the answer was no, I just figured I'd get a hotel for those same dates but keep the schedule. And I was grateful that I never needed a hotel. People came through.
Hmm. Now, your family couldn't go along with you, but why was it important enough to continue the journey on your own?
Well, when I was a kid, I wasn't a tough guy or anything, but I definitely had confidence. And when I lost my left hand, when I lost the ability to see and walk properly, I lost that confidence, and I wanted it back. And you can't just tell yourself you're confident. You've got to earn it. So for me, this was most certainly a test to get back the person that I used to be. But also, my relationship with my students was a personal one, and I knew I wouldn't be able to have the same experience with them if my mother was sitting next to me.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the book, The Priority List, A Teacher's Final Quest to Discover Life's Greatest Lessons. David Menasche is my guest, and you can join us at 800-642-1234. We've got some more calls to take after a short break, and we'll come back and continue our discussion. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the book, The Priority List, with its author, David Menasche, and with you at 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network. So, did you ever get lonely out there on the road by yourself?
Yes, I did, but because I was constantly going to one of my former students, those were brief spouts. I traveled alone, but in between all of the traveling, of course, I was staying with people, not just with them, but on their couch in the middle of their living room. So I would have these spurts where I was overwhelmed by company, which sometimes made the train ride in between rather nice, gave me time to focus, think, and do some writing.
Mm-hmm.
The book that I eventually wrote, The Priority List, was basically written on my phone using voice recognition. While sitting on the train, I would just describe the day that I had, who I had spent it with, in an email. And then I sent that email to myself. And later, after 101 days of consecutive travel, when I finally decided to sit still, I pulled all of those different emails together into a unified narrative, the book that is out today.
Wow.
So the times where I was lonely was the times where I was writing. And those were the times that I became the most introspective, the most reflective, and grateful. Grateful for who I was just with and for who I was about to see.
Tell us about some of the students you stayed with along the way. And what was there a shift in the dynamic between you and your students after they'd been out of school for a while? And, you know, I mean, I'm assuming they had to take care of you. And talk about how all that worked.
Well, I'll say this. The one thing that every single one of my students absolutely had to do with me was have a drink. The idea that they were drinking with their teacher, it was like a rite of passage, that they were now finally adults. And, you know, many of them are in their 30s with kids of their own, some with even grandkids. And, you know, wanting to drink with me was that thing. So there were a lot of conversations at restaurants and bars over whiskey or a glass of wine. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the most common experiences. But beyond that, everything was individual. It was a completely different city, most of which I had never been to before. And I'm spending time with people that I hadn't seen in 15 years. And they had gone on to careers in the military, in the private sector. They got married, they had kids, and I was meeting their friends and their families. So it was a very one-on-one personal kind of thing, a lot like my class. There was no unified change that they had all gone through. They had gone on to individual lives, and I was no longer their teacher. I was now the student. I was the one who was learning what it's like to be an operator for the SEALs or what it's like to work on an oil rig. And it was an honor for me to be able to have the opportunity to shift roles and learn from them. But the main question that I was asking, if you want to go back to what the common denominator was, I wanted to ask all of my students if I made a difference, and if so, what that difference was. And this is something all teachers that I know want the answer to, but few ever get to find out. Once kids leave our classrooms, most of them stay gone forever. But I got to go and see my kids and find out if I was a jerk, if I was too hard, if I was helpful, and it was very rewarding. And it made all the trains and car rides and hitchhiking excursions worth it.
You hitchhiked?
For my why, when necessary. It wasn't my choice. But one of the perks of knowing you're going to die is it gives you a certain sense of fearlessness. Yes, I ended up getting lost in Alabama. And one of my former students from New Orleans was giving me a ride to Atlanta. But we ended up in the middle of nowhere where there was no GPS signal, no phone signal. There weren't even street lights. We couldn't see the signs. And instead of going east, we ended up going north through Mississippi and Tennessee until she finally said, look, I can't just drive you around all night. I've got to work in the morning. And dropped me off at a roadside motel somewhere outside of Mobile, Alabama. I went to the desk clerk and I asked where the train station was, and she described it as just way too far for me to walk to. The bus station was at the same place and told me there was no way I was going to get a cab to come out, that we were 50 miles away from Mobile. I didn't have a choice. So I went out to the road and stuck out my thumb. And now I have my red tip cane and I'm waving it around, trying to flag somebody down to help. And it takes a long time to get someone to stop. But eventually I figured out a strategy and I did get a 18-wheeler, a big rig truck to stop and pick me up. And this guy was really nice and ended up driving me from Mobile, Alabama, all the way to Pensacola, Florida, where I got another ride to Tallahassee and then finally made my way to Atlanta.
Hmm.
Yeah, I was determined to see my kids. I preferred train travel because it allowed me to look out the window and appreciate the sights. When that didn't happen, I would ask if anybody can give me a ride, if not to the next destination, then as close to it as possible. And when that fell through, if I was stuck in some town, yeah, hitchhiking was the answer.
Hmm. Let's take a call from Jim in Superior. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Hi there, John, and thank you for having your guest on. John, I have recently been diagnosed with leukemia, and it was back in December here, and it sort of happened very fast. It was December 6th, a Friday afternoon. Hadn't really told anybody around me that I was going to see a cancer doctor because that might raise everybody's awareness and learn. I really didn't want anybody to think about me. So I went and saw this doctor, and it was a Friday afternoon. And then, lo and behold, on Monday, early in the morning, I'm sitting there getting chemo, you know, pumped into my body, trying to figure out, you know, I'm the one that usually puts the stuff in by choice, and I don't have somebody put the stuff in. So it really happened fast. And so to your the focus of the book and this bucket list, well, I must say that I didn't never really look at it that I have a bucket list, because I just sort of look at what I've been doing and where I've been sort of directing myself and following others around me who would offer me leadership. And really it was always about giving back, and perhaps to your guest's point about his students and how he would nurture and look at the good things and the qualities that he would look for them and work with them. Well, I look at that with the things that the organizations within a community, whether it be in your local community, regionally, or even nationally at the time, I've been able to impact some things. And even though I say I've been able to do it, it's always been because of the folks around me. So that really became the hard thing, is I was so dependent on others all the time to really get to some means or to some end with using them as my means. And so I really didn't want to, you know, how do you do that? You don't call people up and say, hey, you know, I used to hang out with you ringing bells and I'm sick today. You know, it's just something you don't really do very easy. But what I can say is that, so I look at this bucket list and the funny little thing keeps popping up called the honey-do list. And I go, damn, I can't even do the honey-do list right now because I'm sort of in a lockdown situation because of germs and my, you know, what I did do on that Friday night that I found this out is I tried to become an expert on what blood counts meant and neutrophils within your white blood count. And the funny thing is I went in for chemo on a Monday, then I went back on a Tuesday, and I had to go to the hospital for a whole week because my white blood count had hit approximately 400,000, which normally that's like 10 to 50,000, whatever. So I had a week basically in the hospital to start thinking even deeper about, you know, what is the list? What are you doing? And you get a little reflective on...
You and I are very, very similar people, maybe to an unfortunate degree. I can completely relate with the treatment schedule. As soon as I'm off of this phone call, I'm getting chemotherapy today as well. And like you, I didn't want to slow down. I didn't want to be sick and have to tell people I was sick. But what I have learned is that you need to ask for help when you need it, and when you don't need it, you should be offering help. And I'm really glad to hear that you are influencing the lives that you have touched. Whereas we may not all be parents or teachers, we are all touching other people's lives. And I'm happy to hear that you are using the time you have to effect a positive change. A life worth living.
Jim, thanks for the call. Let's go to Pam in Milwaukee next.
Hi, this is just an inspiring morning. And I wanted to ask, How did love as medicine enter all of your experiences here? It's unconditional love is one of the very basic medicines that Native American traditional healers use.
Yes.
And so,
and there's no question that I received an amazing amount of love from the people that I was visiting on the road, from my own family, from my friends. And it went a long way to sustaining me. Chemotherapy is an incredibly lonely experience where, I mean, I don't know how long the last callers normally last, but when I was first starting to get it, I was spending, just for my chemo sessions, about 5 hours at the hospital by myself. Nobody else could take off work for an entire day just to watch me be pumped full of toxins. So it was something that, when I did have a companion, when I did have company with me, just made it a lot easier to deal with, made me feel a lot less ill. And there's no question that medical professionals can treat the body, but it is up to our loved ones to give us that love to feed the soul.
Thanks, Pam, for that call. Let's go to Diane in Pewaukee next. Diane, thanks for being here today.
Oh, thank you. And I just want to say to your guest that you are a courageous and true inspiration to all of us listeners. And thank you so much for sharing your opinions, your experiences, and to remind us that, you know, what really truly matters in life. And I just commend you so much from the bottom of my heart. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Pam, for your kind words. I truly appreciate them. And I hope you enjoy the book.
And the you've described them. You've had your share of health complications since your diagnosis, but you've still managed to outlive your original prognosis. What is it that keeps you going despite all the adversity?
Well, right now I'm going for immortality, and so far, so good. In fact, at this point, I have more proof that I cannot die than that I can. I no longer have a right temporal lobe. I literally have half a brain. I should not be. And I'm not trying to overstate it, but I am a mystery of modern medical science. Doctors at Duke University are studying my tissue to figure out exactly how it is that I am surviving. I don't have the answers to that, and neither do they. But it keeps me interesting to them, so I play along, and if what I'm going through can in turn become research that helps others, I'm all for it. Mm-hmm. Since I stopped traveling, I have become an ambassador for Voices Against Brain Cancer, which is a charity organization that has created a community of patients, caregivers, and medical professionals. And as this ambassador, I've been serving as a pseudo-counselor, helping other people who are going through hard times to realize that no matter what their own illness or disability, heartache, or hardship is, that there is still a way of living a life of purpose, fulfillment, joy, and adventure, but there's still a life to live.
Well, my father, who I lost to lung cancer in 1996, always told me every day on the green side of the sod is a good day.
Absolutely. Any day above Earth is a good day.
So you're really still teaching then, in a way. You never stopped.
Well, I'm still learning. And if I learn something, then it feels selfish not to share it.
Throughout your book, you share letters and emails written by former students about you. What did you learn as you read through all of those? What did you learn about yourself?
I learned that I did make a difference, and that it was, for the most part, a positive one, and that I had spent my time well, and that if I had the chance to do it again, I would do it in a second. And I think that this is something for everybody out there, that we affect the people around us. Even if it's just your colleagues in the office or your family at home, we have a significant and profound effect on them. And the assignment that I gave, the priority list, after, you know, key points in the year, I would have them redo their list, renumbering the words honor, love, possessions, career, education, wealth, etc. And I would come to realize that sometimes those words shifted because of something I had said or done, because of a lesson I had given. And I wanted everybody to know that these daily conversations we have, when you help a stranger get across the street, it changes you. It changes them. You can renew a sense of faith in humanity or in the self with the simplest act of kindness.
Well, that seems like a really great place to end our conversation. David Menashe, thank you so much for a very inspiring hour, and best of luck to you as you continue your journey.
Thank you for having me. I really do appreciate it.
David Menashe is a teacher. I'm not going to say former. I don't believe that. A teacher and author of the book, The Priority List, Teacher's Quest to Discover Life's Greatest Lessons. This program was produced by Cynthia Schuster with on-air production by Bill Martin. Cynthia Schuster also acted as director for this hour. Tomorrow is the Week in Review. Guests from different political perspectives debate and discuss the top headlines of the week, which at this point seem a whole lot less significant than they might otherwise have. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.